Hello from Holden Village in the Cascade Mountains, state of Washington. Today is June 16th, 1998. And in the fireside room this morning is our second session of Bible study. And the presenter is again Esther Mann. And her theme for today is the series Biblical Feet, Where Faith Hits the Ground. And this is on Exodus 3. This is tape number MEE98-11.
My name's Esther Mann, for those of you who haven't met me yet. And this week, we are celebrating our Holden theme, Guide Our Feet, by looking at biblical passages that have feet in them. So yesterday, we looked at the Canticle of Zechariah that had that phrase, Guide Our Feet. And today we're going to look at Moses' bare feet at the burning bush. So it's going to be a study of the third chapter of Exodus. And I was saying to some people up here that I hope that they liked their shoes when they came in. You didn't have to take them off. That's sort of like our little parallel here.
You have to take them off in Sweden.
In
the
Sweden?
Daughter that lives there, it's just Swedes when they come in the door.
Do you really?
Yep. Oh. They give you little slippers to put on or something. Mm-hmm.
No, they do that thing in Japan. In Japan.
So that's to keep the house clean?
Clean. Yeah, I don't know. They've done it for years, so just provide this. Take your shoes off.
Mm-hmm. It seems to have also been a custom in the cultures that appear in the Bible too. When the guests would come, they'd wash their feet, take off their shoes and wash their feet.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't it because they wore sandals though?
They did wear sandals.
Mm-hmm. And their feet were dirty.
Most of the time. Their feet were very dirty. So, like walking around here on the Holden streets, I was wearing some fairly new little shoes down to chapel, and by the time I got down to chapel, they looked like my old shoes.
Yeah.
Because all the dust on them. So you walk around in that kind of dust with sandals, your feet do get pretty...
Last Friday we had in Narnia, we had our study was on feet, and they washed each other's, well, they washed their own feet, and then we tried to get them to wash each other's feet. Some of them did, and some of them didn't want to wash each other's feet.
Okay, good.
They enjoyed it.
I had a similar experience in my Sunday school class on that story, and actually that's one of the stories of feet that we'll be looking at on Friday. So today we have Moses' bare feet at the burning bush. Here's a man who shows up, takes off his shoes, and then has to get ready to have his feet guided on a long journey, sent away from this holy site, promised that he'll return again. But it really sets him off on a long journey, actually. Next time we're going to look at the poetry in the book of Isaiah about the beautiful feet of the messenger of good tidings. And then we'll also look at Mary at Jesus' feet, both learning and anointing his feet with perfume, this kind of story of adoration and discipleship. And then we'll look at the story of Jesus washing his feet as a type of service as leadership. So these are some stories that stuck out in my mind about feet. And they seem to tie into the theme of practicing our faith that's being emphasized here at Holden this summer. I was glancing through the table of contents, wondering what practice Exodus 3 might illustrate, and I thought, well, maybe discernment. Yeah, well, you can see what you think. Discernment, he had to sort of see that he was in holy ground, and then he was sent out, and he had all these protestations. He keeps saying, I don't know, I don't think I'm the right person. Yeah, you are. I don't know, I'm not so eloquent. You know, they're not going to believe it. So process of questioning and answering until God gets kind of angry with them for trying to discern too much. discernment, maybe saying yes and saying no. I don't know, it's really a story of vocation in a way. The guy starts out as a shepherd. He's actually an outlaw. He's hiding. He had to leave civilization. He had to leave Egypt because he killed somebody. He's a murderer. So he's off, and he happened to take up with a Midianite man, and he get married and sort of start his life over. Now he's a shepherd out in the wilderness, but really he's, he can't go back with any safety. Well, there he is. And after this encounter, he's sent on a completely different course. He really receives his vocation. He discovers God in a place, in this bush, and at the same time, he is discovered by God and sent on his path, which is a very important one for the whole story of Israel. So what I would suggest is reading, this is, it's long, and we may not get through in any detail, but reading through in sections, even the whole chapter, we can divide it up in sections, just because if we emphasize a certain point, a certain passage, then we don't have it in the larger context. Would somebody like to begin by reading verses 1 to 6? Thank you.
Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led his flock beyond the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of a fire out of a bush. He looked and the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. Then Moses said, I must turn aside and look at the great sight to see why the bush is not burning up.
No, you can keep going until six.
Okay. When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called out to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. Then he said, Come no closer. Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. He said further, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God.
Mm-hmm. I suggest we just read it straight through, and then we'll go back and look at certain parts. So 7 to 12, would somebody read? Okay, Anne, up in the balcony there.
Then the Lord said, I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them from the Egyptians and to bring them out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the country of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. The cry of the Israelites has now come to me. I have also seen how the Egyptians oppressed them. So come, I will send you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? He said, I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that it is I who sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God on this mountain.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. What about 13 through 15?
But Moses said to God, If I come to the Israelites and say to them, The God of your ancestors has sent me to you, and they ask me, What is his name? What shall I say to them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. He said further, Thus you shall say to the Israelites, I am has sent me to you. God said to Moses, Thus you shall say to the Israelites, The Lord, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my title for all generations.
Mm-hmm. And then the next part is very long, recounting what God's intentions are here for the people, 16 through 22, but just so we can read a chapter. Will somebody... Go ahead.
Go and assemble the elders of Israel and say to them, The Lord, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I have given heed to you and to what has been done to you in Egypt. I declare that I will bring you up out of the misery of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. They will listen to your voice, and you and the elders of Israel shall go to the king of Egypt and say to him, "The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. Let us now go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness, so that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God."
Mm-hmm. Do you want to just continue through the end of the...
I know, however, that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my wonders that I will perform in it. After that, he will let you go. I will bring this people into such favor with the Egyptians that when you go, you will not go empty-handed. Each woman shall ask her neighbor and any woman living in the neighbor's house for jewelry of silver and of gold and clothing, and you shall put them on your sons and on your daughters, and so you shall plunder the Egyptians.
Okay.
I think you remember that.
I never heard that before.
Plunder the Egyptians. Maybe they're just getting their back salary. Don't you think? I mean, they've been working without wages all these years. It certainly shows a different perspective than of the status quo, the ruling class, doesn't it? This is a problem for the first session, too. They thought, oh, I don't remember that. That wasn't in the story when I heard it in Sunday school. But anyway, maybe we can go back and be with Moses there, keeping his father-in-law's flock out in the wilderness to Horeb. Now, Horeb is another name for Sinai. They're used as references to the same place, to the mountain where God made his covenant with the people after they left Egypt. So there you have the giving of the Ten Commandments and the other laws and the making of the covenant. So God promised to be with the people, and they would take him as their one God and King. And so what attracts Moses here? This is rather interesting. It says the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of a bush. And the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. So what's his reaction to all this here?
He was curious.
Very curious.
Mm-hmm.
So he turns his song.
Gotta check it out.
He's gotta check it out. Now, what's he so curious about?
I suppose he's wondering how it can burn without being consumed.
Right. And he doesn't seem to be so interested in that it's burning, but he wants to know what's going on. It's rather unusual. So what do you think about this appearance and a flame of fire out of a bush? Does this strike any chords of resonance, or is this very strange? Do you have any?
Still have plants called the burning bush.
Oh, that's, yeah. Because of their red,
the leaves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Must come from biblical.
Yeah, I think it's a kind of a biblical allusion.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Aren't there other references to God kind of appearing in Pentecost?
Pentecost, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, Pentecost would be a great example of the appearance of the flames of fire as
of a pillar of fire, as the Egyptian or Israelites are going through Sinai. They have a pillar of
the
fire.
The pillar of fire.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, didn't Daniel too? Wasn't there a fire? And angels came in this fire when Daniel was in prison?
I think so.
Sometimes there's an angel with a sword of fire.
Mm-hmm.
Fiery chariot.
Fiery chariot. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In the book of Judges, Samson's parents, Manoah and his wife, an angel appears to them, and they offer him food, and he disappears in a flame of fire.
Cool.
There's another fiery manifestation. You might say that when God appeared to Abraham and made the covenant with him in Genesis 15, he was instructed to cut up some animals and lay them on either side, and then there's this smoky fire pot that goes through the pieces, and God makes this covenant with Abraham and promises him descendants and land and blessing and to be with the people even through their dark periods. I think of Sinai, where he returns, and there's all these fiery manifestations too. And I don't know, some of you might have been here when we studied Psalm 104 last week. Psalm 104 was a hymn, praise concerning the creation. And in verse 4, the winds were seen as God's messengers, and the fire and flame were seen as his ministers. So it's a lot of association with fire and the divine. Even the whole sacrificial system at the temple involved burning animals and other things, flour and so forth. It's kind of means of communication as the smoke, the fire went up. There's some kind of connection. It seems like a really natural symbol in a way.
But I think, you know, even if you see a burning building, you have to stop and look at it, you know, mm-hmm. It's such a, or whatever, even a candle
mm-hmm.
attracts you.
Mm-hmm. So it has this sort of automatic appeal or attraction because it's so bright. Mm-hmm. And,
Seems like kind of an attention-getting device, though. I mean, as soon as God sees that Moses, he's got Moses' attention,
mm-hmm.
then he says, goes on. He says, when the Lord saw that he had turned aside, then he starts talking to him. It's mm-hmm. almost like the bush is there to just get him mm-hmm. to enter into dialogue or get his attention. And
mm-hmm. so the fire has that the ability to do that, to really capture your attention. And it also is seems so warm, you know, inviting. It has this, all these lovely properties. It's useful. And then, but on the other hand, you can't get too close to it.
There's a fear factor with fire. When mm-hmm. I see some of these, if I see a house on fire, it's almost a fear that makes me look at it more than an attraction.
Mm-hmm.
But how many people follow a fire engine? I mean, you know, there are people that just do that.
Mm-hmm. So maybe it both attracts, but yet there's awesome
danger.
Power, there's danger. Mm-hmm. So it's really an appropriate symbol, I think, this fire. It attracts him, and yet the Lord's watching Moses, and when he sees that he turned, he said, come no closer. So he's attracted, and he's told, you know, keep your distance also. So there's a sort of recognition both of the attraction and yet of the power and, you know, the inability of humans to get closer or, you know, to become really close and intimate. So it's a very appropriate symbol, I think. Any other?
I think it's in the Green Book in the Vesper Service.
Mm-hmm.
We used to sing about the light, the darkness cannot, you know, what's the word?
Penetrate?
Yeah.
Whatever.
The darkness is overcome.
Mm-hmm.
It refers to the light.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's very small, it's mm-hmm. still there, visible.
Mm-hmm. All right, this might recall those images too of light.
Right.
And what about this bush here? Any resonance with the bushes or trees in the your sort of your file cabinet up here? Biblical stories.
Adam and Eve.
Yeah, see. Uh-huh.
And there's so many, you know, the vineyard stories. And the axe is at the root of the tree.
Mm-hmm.
The tree that probably does not.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
You have at the very beginning of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, the tree of life. The tree of life that shows up later in Revelation, the picture of the restored Jerusalem, the rivers of life, the river of life's flowing, and the tree of life are standing on, trees of life are standing on either side. So there's that image of the tree. Abraham camps out by trees a lot, Oaks of Mamre. And even the menorah, the candlestick that's used in the temple, has branches and, okay, and petals. Mm-hmm. So it's depicted as a tree symbol as well, and it's burning. And I don't know if you know the story of Hanukkah, the origins of the festival of Hanukkah. We're all about taking back the temple from the Hellenistic rulers. There was a ruler named Antiochus Epiphanes in around 167 before the Common Era, and he decided to turn the temple in Jerusalem into a temple for the worship of Zeus. He saw himself as kind of an epiphany of Zeus, and so he cleared it out and began to convert it. And this caused a great revolt, and it was called the Maccabean War, and they cleaned out the temple, and in 164 it was rededicated. There wasn't very much oil, but yet the miracle was that it continued burning much longer. So it was that motif of the menorah, the tree, the symbol of the tree burning, and yet the oil is not consumed, you know, so the lights continue. And I think in Christianity we pick up on the image of the tree, the cross becomes the tree. And so this is another symbol that you see, kind of arboreal imagery. Trees are another kind of natural thing that we see around that people resonate to. There's a tree walk today, by the way, too. But it seems to be kind of an enduring symbol throughout the pages of biblical history as well, even though it might not be as obvious as a fire image. So he's attracted to this, and he wants to see why the bush isn't burned up. The Lord's watching him as he turns aside from his business, and so he calls out to him, calls him by name, actually, Moses, Moses, and he responds. And he tells him, he kind of halts him there, come no closer, remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. He's told to remove his sandals. And I don't know, perhaps some of you have been to places where this is a custom before entering into a shrine or a temple or another holy site. Can you tell us about that?
I grew up in Saudi Arabia. And before entering a mosque, you have to remove your sandals and wash your feet. Mm-hmm. I, of course, am not able to go as a Christian woman, but that's the custom, that you must wash your feet and have your sandals off. Mm-hmm. Actually, you have to wash your hands as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any other personal experience with this kind of practice?
In Turkey, when we went into one of the mosques, if you had too short sleeves on, you weren't allowed in. Mm-hmm. And we would walk in, and if you weren't dressed appropriately, they handed you something just to put on, mm-hmm, as kind of a, I guess, reverence or something. You know, and they told us the day before that we needed to watch what we wear, mm-hmm, what we wore that day. And a couple of the people in the group who, you know, thought they were okay but weren't, were handed something before they went into the mosque. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It was nice of them to provide those little shawls for you.
Dorothy.
Well, I had that same experience just even going to a cathedral in Europe sometimes, and this is the, mm-hmm, practice. But it strikes me that here I'm being asked to take something off, not put something on. Moses is being asked to take something off. Mm-hmm. And it does make you vulnerable to be out in the wilderness or on a mountain with no shoes on. You know, there's a opening up of the self and, mm-hmm, sharing your bare feet. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a certain kind of danger in going barefoot in a place like this. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting contrast there, because the kind of holy places that we've been talking about have been the humanly constructed, yeah, mm-hmm, mosques or
carpeted.
What's, yeah, that?
All the mosques are always beautifully carpeted.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's true. Mm-hmm. But here he's out in the wilderness. And it's in the middle of nowhere, really. Although, according to the story, the whole people come back to this site eventually. So it's not a site that's immediately lost. There's no temple that's ever built out there. There's no memory of where this place is. The place where St. Catherine's is now, it's called Mount Sinai. It's actually a later tradition, and it's a Christian site now. And so it's really not a place that's remembered or commemorated in any way, in the Jewish tradition anyway, which kind of sets it apart from some of the earlier theophanies. You think of Jacob at Bethel. He had this dream of the angels going up and down, and when he woke up, you know, the first thing he did was he set up a memorial stone and anointed it, and then that became basis of a shrine, of a holy site there. But this is a bit different. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did somebody? Yes.
When we were at PLU in campus ministry, we had one kind of eccentric student who always came to the Eucharist barefoot.
Because he
played the Eucharist was holy ground and you should never wear shoes.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only one I've known.
Mm-hmm.
Practice that.
Well, that's wonderful. So it wasn't a place, it was the Eucharist that he felt was the holy ground.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a beautiful example of an interpretation of this. Thank you. So we might, this is an interesting thing, keep this in mind, we might reflect further on about people we've known who have experienced different sites of the holy or our own experiences. That's an excellent way of departure. So, holy, what kind of things strike you when you hear the word holy? It's kind of
a... Possessed by spirit.
Of the spirit,
mm-hmm. Pure.
Pure, mm-hmm.
Set apart,
mm-hmm. That's actually the sort of the base meaning, mm-hmm. Sort of set apart, consecrated, set apart for the divine. So God is holy just by nature, right? Because it's set apart for the divinity. People can be holy as they associate with that divine, or places can be holy if they're set apart for God's presence or the divine.
Powerful,
mm-hmm. Sort of power in that.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Very good. So now there he's there with bare feet on this holy ground. And next comes this identification of this divine. Who's talking here? And the first identification is that I'm the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. So there's this drawing in of all the old traditions, identification with all of the stories of the patriarchs. And at that moment, Moses hides his face. So now he has bare feet and a hidden face because he's afraid to look. So what a picture of vulnerability there. You know, he's taken off his feet, as you say, Dorothy, that's kind of a dangerous place to take off your feet in the middle of nowhere, and now he's covered his eyes because he's afraid to look at God. And as it continues, there's sort of more references to this motif of looking. So Moses is afraid of looking, but the Lord has looked, says, I've observed it. It's the same word in Hebrew. I've looked at the misery of my people. So Moses is awestruck, doesn't want to look at God, but yet God has looked at the misery of the people. Moses can't look at God's
you know, the glory or whatever, but God's looking at the misery. And so there's a recount here of their cry. He's heard the cry, he's known the sufferings and so forth. And there's this revelation of his intentions to change their situation here, to bring them out of slavery and up to a good and broad land. And then there's this revelation that he's going to send Moses to Pharaoh. So not only is his intention revealed, but now Moses is drawn into this whole plan that's revealed at this very time. I mean, it's a very human reaction. We have two objections during this chapter, right? At first he says, well, who am I? Who am I? Later, in 13, he wonders, well, but what's the name I should reveal? How are they going to believe who sent me? Notice in his first objection, you know, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? God's response is, I will be with you. I will be with you. What we don't see in that translation there is actually that's the same word, the I will be, is the same word as you have later in 14, I am, Ephyeh in Hebrew, Ephyeh. So already I am with you. So there's already this play on the name of God, Ephyeh, or I am, here. Who am I? I am with you. So, and he's given a sign, which is rather an odd sign, right? Usually a sign is something that will reassure somebody that is on the right track. The sign is that the people will return here. That's a long, he's going to have to wait a long time to see that sign. He has a great mobilization there before he'll ever see that. So then the objection comes next. 13, if I come to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your ancestors has sent to me, they're going to ask me, what's his name? And so here you have this curious passage. God said to Moses, I am who I am. He said further, thus you shall say to the Israelites, I am has sent me to you. So I'm wondering, perhaps we can, from this group, get a number of interpretations, perhaps things that you've heard or your own conclusions. Is this purposefully cryptic? You're not giving the identity? Or does this say something about God's nature and freedom? What's the sense that you get out of these words?
Well, I love these two words because they say about as much as we can possibly say in language about God, really, like without limiting God in some way. To say I am means that at any point in our limited understanding of history, I am. He exists, you know, or she exists, or God exists. And there, that's beyond time. That's beyond everything that we can understand. So it is not easily understood, but it's true. It's probably the truest statement of or description of God. Mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. So.
Thank you.
I am the beginning and the end.
Mm-hmm. Very encompassing. Mm-hmm. So are we saying that it both is somewhat obscure and mysterious, and yet you're saying it does say something essential about the freedom and the encompassing nature?
I think it's probably the only way to describe, but I think that it's not easily understood.
It makes me think of a realm where time was not a part of that realm. And there are ways that you can look at that kind of thing mathematically, where all of a sudden time is no longer part of what you're working. and just the concept that maybe time is a dimension or something that's more of a tool for us rather than an absolute that it has to be everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Are you drawing in to the discussion also this next verse, this is my name forever, and this is my title for all generations, that kind of timeless?
No, really just the concept of I am, that where I sit, all of time is just there, not a moment-to-moment progression, but that it's just all there.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it beyond human nature to be able to even understand all of this and so on and so forth, because it's God and it's there. Mm-hmm. And it just, doesn't expect us to understand all of this.
So there's a giving of a name that implies that inexhaustibility or that plenitude or whatever we might say. Yeah.
Well, how would you describe God? When we ask somebody, you know, who we meet, we ask them, what do you do? A barber or a professor or a school teacher, something like that. That's how we are known. That's our identity. But how could you, God, what would you say about him?
I think you're onto something there. Because actually the Hebrew word ehyeh, which is from this root haya, is the... I guess we spelled it that. But anyway, it's from this root haya, which means more than sort of like being, you know, this concept of being, essence, or something like that. It's more active. It's like occurring or happening. It's more verbal than our linking verb, be, or something, you know, kind of our ontological verb. So you could translate it, I am who I am, I will be who I will be, I happen wherever I happen,
I'm always there.
I am where I am, where I am, you can almost say, or, you know, I'm present where I'm present, So it has a little bit more of an active kind of doing quality to it, and that might even tie into some of these plans that we've been hearing too for the Israelites, to bring them out of Egypt. So here you do have kind of a description of what God's doing or what plans to do too. So you're right about drawing that distinction, is that, you know, we define ourselves by particular jobs or whatever. You can't do that with God, but maybe, you know, some of God's nature or essence or whatever is in the plans that he has for people in history, such as this example. You know, I mean, the longest part of the passage is not about sort of God's existence, timeless existence, or, you know, presence in all of nature or that. It's okay.
Excuse me, I didn't mean to know. In your Ten Commandments, you know, what is God? I mean, that was always an honor and confirmation. Who gets to say that? You know, God is Spirit Almighty, ever-present, omniscient, everywhere-present. You know, it goes on and on with that.
All the list, uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Right. And if you got to do that your confirmation Sunday, that you were the best student in the class. That was important.
Very nice. And here, this being of God or whatever seems to be tied up with where he is and what he's doing. You know, I am with you, he says to Moses. I am with you. I'm present with you. I am who I am. I've heard this misery. I'm going to send you to start turning things around. I'm going to act through you and so forth. So he's identifying this I am almost in this sort of these passages about what his plans are for the people. What do you think about that reading?
Yeah, I think that's right. It's
You imagine today, you know, people getting in the presence of something that's burning and just having this experience of detachment and this peace and spirituality and kind of looking into the candle flame and feeling a kind of peace that just lets you sit there. You know, that's kind of spirituality is in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And this is very different. I'm looking at something that's burning and that is a divine epiphany.
Mm-hmm.
But which is ascending, which mm-hmm. is a, it's not just sit here and have a religious experience.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's much more, some things have already happened, some things are going to happen, it puts him into history.
Mm-hmm. He does recognize the moment by taking off his shoes.
Yes, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
But
and there is the eternity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is my title for all generations. There is the present.
Mm-hmm.
Holiness, and there is the eternity,
mm-hmm.
but it's all there framed in this actual suffering people and mm-hmm. hard work to do and purposes in life.
Mm-hmm. Sending him out
yeah.
to a job he doesn't really want at all,
mm-hmm.
right?
Great.
I'm not the right person. They're not going to recognize who are you. They're not going to believe me. And I'm just not eloquent,
mm-hmm.
you know? So he goes through the whole list of objections.
Uh-huh. You asked at the beginning what practice this might be,
mm-hmm.
relate to. I think testimony, in a sense that I am is giving Moses a lesson in testimony, or in what to say, and how to speak, and to speak, you know?
Mm-hmm.
By giving the testimony first, God's self doing that, telling the story.
So you think it's God's testimony, or?
Well, God is teaching Moses what to say.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, is this the first time in Exodus that we hear, that we get this link to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob?
It's explicit. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have the reference to the 12 tribes early on, so there's a link to what's happened before in Genesis, but mm-hmm. this explicit link here with the God of the ancestors, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the God of the Exodus story.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Yeah. Who am I? And God's telling him, you're enough because yeah. you're not acting alone.
That's true.
Because mm-hmm. I'm behind
with
you.
As opposed to the other guy standing over here, I'm not with him. Mm-hmm.
Either that or maybe Moses has just been chosen for this particular work and sent
because
out.
Because he was a shepherd?
Mm-hmm.
Because he was a shepherd.
I don't know why, because maybe you can imagine, maybe he had the right kind of training in Pharaoh's house, and you know, he spoke both languages, or you know, you can kind of invent that, but really there's sort of a mystery. There's no real good reasons, like, okay, I chose you because, you know, you're bilingual, because you're, you know, all these things. There's no real good reasons. You're enough, because I'm
with you.
I think you're right. That's the question. You're not given the list because you're righteous, because
uh-huh.
we have to, because we're a murderer. I mean, for one thing, he's not totally, you know, has a clean CV.
Well, as an infant, he was saved and, you know, in water,
right,
and then cared for after, so it's like he was special from the very beginning,
right,
as all of us are supposed to be, but Moses particular.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think he's showing that, you know, here's this common person. He's not a king. He's not, you know, anything spectacular. He's just common, like you.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What I find wonderful about this statement is, anytime we ask the question why, we're not easily going to get an answer. And the proper answer that God has for us is, well, I'm with you. There may not be an answer to why. But I'm with you. you know, and I find it very comforting, this statement of, I am with you, so don't ask why, I'll be there. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll get through it together. Mm-hmm. And I love this statement, because he's all nervous, and mm-hmm. God's like, don't worry about it, I'm there. Mm-hmm. So I see it not so much as I'm setting you apart, although he is mm-hmm. setting Moses apart. I see it more as stop worrying, because he worries in the next chapter the whole way through, you know. And I see it more as chill out, you know, it'll be okay, you know.
Mm-hmm. Given what's just happened prior to this, I'm surprised Moses doesn't say to God, God, don't you remember what just happened? And you want me to go back there? Mm-hmm. And
right.
And that doesn't he says it later on, but in this first encounter, he doesn't say, God, like, I can't go back there.
They're going to kill
that
me.
That caught me, that he doesn't even bring that up in the list of his many arguments.
Mm-hmm. Personal safety isn't.
Yeah. He worries more about his feet, more so than his.
It'll be ineffective, mm-hmm. or that he doesn't want to take it on, or they won't be believed.
Yeah.
They won't know what God is talking about. They aren't going to believe him. He's not going to be eloquent. So he's more worried that he won't be able to accomplish
what God wants him to do. But don't you think he thinks he's not going to be believed because he did kill this Israelite?
Mm. Or the Egyptian.
You know, the Egyptian, excuse me. You know, and the Israelites weren't with him at that point either. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Factors in. We have just a few minutes. Does anybody want to reflect on any modern versions, whether personal or more corporate, of this kind of experience of the holy and kind of ascending or commissioning? And perhaps that would take a few minutes of reflection, but if anybody able to think of
one of the things
example.
That I like is kind of like she said, Moses has these things in his past that make him, in people's eyes at the time or in his own eyes, that he's not this person without fault or blame. So, in reading that and then saying, you know, why'd you pick me? And the whole thing is that that doesn't matter because God is with him. And that just really brings it to light that in our own lives, when we've had mistakes in the past that isn't particularly appealing or had gone on the wrong track, that what matters is if God's with you and God's leading you somewhere, to be obedient to that and to not worry, you know, that, you know, I've done this or whatever, that, I mean, there's so many examples in the Bible that some of the people he chose were, you know, you could throw a lot of stones at, that they weren't people without blame, but that God was with them and that they chose to follow the Lord and be obedient to the Lord.
Would this be an argument against capital punishment that you would execute Moses's and David's and I don't know that ever been used?
I've never heard it used, but it seems like the strongest characters, yeah, Moses, David.
Just a comment about holy places in general. Sometimes holy places can be different for different people and take on different meaning. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, there was a group of us who went. And in some ways, the supposedly most holy place, in some ways we were disappointed in it because it was so crowded and it was so ornate and all this gold and all this, you know, in some way we were all kind of taken aback and we did not find that the most place that we were closest to God on that particular trip. And you would think, you know, the place where Jesus was crucified, that should have been great. But we didn't necessarily experience that. The advisors could tell that a lot of us were just kind of going, what did we just experience? And so we went back at a quieter time later on and just to re-experience in it. experience it a different way. But I think holy places are different for different people, and people respond to different places and places where they feel near to God. The whole image of holy ground and sacred places.
Thank you. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, just to be a contrarian about seeing this passion particularly comforting. I think that one of the, it's still an open question at this point, because as the call starts and it comes to Moses and he goes, who am I? I mean, maybe if some of us are chosen for something, that's our first response too, who am I? And the answer is provided. But then I think comes the more challenging question. Moses turns back and asks God, well, who are you? And at that point, you know, like, okay, well, you pick me. But yeah, who are you to pick me? And we get in that sense, I think, a very crypt, well, I am who I am. Well, yeah, thanks. You know, I'm not quite sure how helpful that is in sending anybody out and making that kind of decision. And it seems to me that Moses, I mean, part of understanding this God who says, I am who I am, that I am this happening, I am this aliveness, is almost a wait and see kind of attitude in terms of what will happen. And that it seems that it always places Moses in a position of questioning at that point, always rather than assurance. And just one place to point that out, when they do come back to Sinai in this area, and after the covenant is given and the people start complaining, this is from Numbers chapter 11, verse 11, just to give one example here to show how Moses is still on edge. This Moses says to God, why have you treated your servant so badly? Why have I not found favor in your sight that you lay the burden of all this people on me? Did I conceive all this people? Did I give birth to them that you should say to me, carry them in your bosom as a nurse carries a sucking child to the land that you promised on an oath to their ancestors? Where am I to get meat to give to all these people? For they come weeping to me and say, give us meat to eat. I am not able to carry all this people alone, for they are too heavy for me. If this is the way you are going to treat me, put me to death at once. If I have found favor in your sight, and do not let me see my misery. Uh-huh. I mean, Moses is not a happy person. And so I think this calling and this becoming involved with this I am who I am is tremendously challenging. It puts one, I mean, as Moses said, you know, God, if you're really on my side, kill me now. I mean, that's, so I think that this whole introduction here and this sense about feet, I think it was an old Bill Cosby thing about God calling Moses and, you know, taking off your feet. It's the hot, I was thinking, it's the hot desert sand. You take off your sandals out of hot desert sand, and now you just burn the soles. I mean, I kind of see Moses standing there, you know, shuffling from foot to foot. And I see that as kind of the faith journey. Anyway, I see this as much more a discomforting kind of than comforting it sometimes.
I appreciate you bringing that up, and that was an excellent passage to read. Yeah, that's a good point. You say, okay, Moses says, who am I? And then he says, I'm with you. And the question is, well, who are you? And he does give this cryptic answer, but then he gives this long description of his plan. So it's almost as if the plan sort of describes the, you know, the I am at this point. It seems like Moses goes along with it, because his next question is, well, what if they don't believe me? So then it becomes an issue of credibility or whatever. So it seems like he says, well, at least he's agreeing to the point that, well, okay, I'm with the plan, but, you know, what if they don't believe me? I'm not eloquent, so he's not up to it. But you're right, it's not an easy thing throughout it, and that's an excellent passage that you
bread. And I liked your image of the sand, the burning sand, too. That was great.
But we have to remember that Moses had been schooled by his mother, so he probably had been told this covenant. So he knew about it. God with his, with the forefathers, the covenant with between Isaac and Abraham.
Yeah, we don't know anything. That's interesting. Possibly. We don't know anything about his education, do we? You must know something about the God
of Abraham. But see, she took care of him, you know, and raised him, nurtured him.
He must have known something about that because he's like identified by that. And that seems to make sense.
He certainly wouldn't have learned that from the Egyptians.
Right. You had somebody say the new,
In reference to that, how often does God put something in front of us in our life and we say, no way, I can't do that, and then if you do feel it's the Lord leading you there, quite often it is a challenge out of an area that you're comfortable to where you grow, kind of in the same way where Moses was saying, you know, I can't do that. And then knowing when you got to the end and it all came full circle as it was for Moses, to know that that was real affirmation, you know, that was the Lord in the, you know, what he was saying, I am and all that. But it gives just the affirmation as the things fall into place that, yes, that was the Lord. How that happens in your life when the Lord puts something in front of you. A challenge.
You want to piggyback on that?
Keep going back, Esther, to what you said at the very outset about turning points and how Moses had taken this one course, fled to this region, and then this big turning point comes for him, and God appears to him, and his life takes a whole different course entirely. And I keep associating that with this question of holy ground and thinking that maybe that's a definition of holy ground, is a place where change happens and where life and life and faith just takes a big turn in the direction that you have no way of anticipating or preparing for, but there it goes. Not only in life, like day-to-day life or course of life, like career or something, but also in your relationship with God, or how you understand what you believe.
Did you want to say something?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Is it interesting that Moses actually doesn't enter that good and broad land flowing with milk and honey either, right? But it's part of the bigger picture, that he gets the ball rolling. And he actually doesn't end up accomplishing the big scheme. So he's taking on a big task, and God's with him, but still, you kind of sense, I don't know what, that's just kind of a powerful image to me, that he himself never completes the journey. Well, thank you very much for the discussion, which I enjoyed very much. And so please come back if you're able. We'll see you around.
Thank you.
Thank you.